ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Jesse Grischtink. He's a graduate from Union College with a dual degree in computer science and economics. When he was a sophomore at Union, his passion for electronic music and cryptocurrencies led him to a managing editor position at dancingastronaut.com. As Bitcoin was still an emerging technology at the time, he chose to enter the music industry as an intern at ID&T North America. While there, he spent 2 months as the managing director of marketing for the Tomorrow World Music Festival. After graduation, he then went on to work for SFX Entertainment, managing cashless payment technology and access control at live events, as well as conducting research and planning for implementation of newer, more consumer-focused cashless systems. In the beginning of 2015, he joined Consensus, a venture production studio building decentralized applications and various developer and end-user tools for blockchain. He is also a co-founder of Ujo Music, a music application that aims to simplify how musicians are paid and would enable better management of artist royalties. Jesse, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I would like to know in simple terms, because some of the people who are listening don't really know, and it's quite frankly, even though I've read a number of papers on it, a little confusing and I get lost in it. Can you explain in layman terms what blockchain is first?
Absolutely, and don't worry about that. I've been trying to explain it for 5 years and I find myself explaining it different ways each time. So I will do my best.
Excellent.
So blockchains are essentially a data structure for computer data. And what makes them unique or different and exciting is that they enable trust on a global scale. So we're not utilizing centralized companies, meaning companies like Facebook or Google or even the United States government, for example, to regulate the software. The blockchain software runs off of basically rules and algorithms designed to maintain the system. So it's very logic-based.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically you're allowing the communication and the transaction of value essentially through the internet, through a trusted system that is not maintained by any singular party.
So if it's not maintained by any singular party, who maintains it?
So basically anyone who wants can run the software to maintain these structures, these computer programs essentially. And so there's groups of people all around the world running the software, and they're incentivized to run the software because they're given essentially a digital currency for basically using and running the software on their computers.
Wouldn't that make the so the data resides, it's distributed across, it's an open platform, it's wherever there's data, there's network, wherever there's network, there's data. It's these altruists who aren't totally altruistic because they're getting what cryptocurrency to run it. What if their computer is open and hacked? Does the whole system get hacked because it's all one system?
So that's a great question. So in traditional systems, the centralized location where the computer software or servers are running,
mm-hmm.
If those get compromised, the entire system goes down.
Right.
In a blockchain-based system, since, like you said, everything is distributed, right? So you have people, you know, I think the Ethereum network, which is what we build on, has about 7,000 or 8,000 servers, essentially, people mm-hmm. running these software for basically just running a software. And every single one of those people has a copy of the data. And so if one of these computers is compromised, they kind of get excluded from the network, essentially. So if they try to submit data that doesn't check out, essentially, because so essentially what's going on is every step of the way, there's a transaction.
Mm-hmm.
And these transactions, the way the data is stored, it's all cryptographically secured. So every step of the way, if something were to change in the previous, it would reflect in the current state.
Right.
So basically, you can't go back and change history without changing the present. So if one of these computers were to be compromised, you wouldn't be able to, their data wouldn't check out with the rest of the network, and essentially it would be rejected.
I see. So there's no way to then sort of virally infect it or to sort of wolf in sheep's clothing Trojan horse your way in?
No, there is not. And so anytime you hear about these hacks or anything going on with Bitcoin, for example, what's going on is the passwords that protect individual accounts have been compromised.
Oh.
Or the companies that basically exchange Bitcoin for US dollars or Bitcoin for other currencies.
Mm-hmm.
It's those websites that have been attacked.
I had heard that Ethereum was hacked. Is that not right?
So what you had probably had heard was the DAO. And so that was essentially, the DAO stands for Distributed Autonomous Organization,
mm-hmm.
meaning an organization that has no central authority.
Right.
So basically what happened was this company came out and released rules for how this would operate. And they said, you know, we'll take investments and we want to take your investments and then all as a group vote on where we invest the money.
Okay.
So it was essentially a distributed head or VC firm.
Right.
Except what happened was they had a little bit of an error in their code that allowed the money to kind of leak out.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really bad.
Yeah, it was really bad. So what happened was they got all this interest. You know, a lot of people were like, oh my God, this could be really cool. They ended up raising about, at the time it was worth about $150 million in digital currency. But because of this little error in the data, in the basically the contract that they wrote, like the rules for the software,
mm-hmm.
Hackers were able to extract about $70 million, I believe.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was a bit of a rough patch, but
that's a $70 million rough patch. I think that's a pretty big rough patch. Simply speaking, blockchain is this network, decentralized. The content exists and is uniform. It exists everywhere and nowhere at the same time. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's fair.
So how could it challenge the current structure of the music industry?
The music industry right now, there's two big problems kind of at the core of things. With payments and with data. So
okay.
On the data side of things, every single one of these companies in the music industry has a different database, right? You know, the traditional computer database, you know, a SQL database that you have, you know, Sony's database, Universal's database. If the rights to a song get sold, you know, like for example, when Sony bought EMI, these have to get updated not only in their database, but in every single database of music rights that exists.
Right. So people then know if they want to license it, who the rights holder is, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
So it quickly becomes this complex web of, is it right? Is it correct? You know, so that kind of causes a slowdown on the payment side of things. So you have these two kind of core problems that really are pretty inherent to the music industry and are why a lot of this stuff is done in what, you know, like a black box kind of situation where you can't really see what's happening. You get a check, the mailbox money, as they call it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get a check every couple months from whoever was collecting on your behalf.
Right. Right. So you have no idea that you also don't understand the relationship between people listening to your music and where the intermediary payments are being siphoned off, how much those payments are, I suppose, you know, the sort of reconciling you have to, there's a certain amount of faith that goes on, right?
Absolutely. You know, the music industry is definitely based in trust.
Right. So I can see, you know, obviously blockchain, you know, if you have, you create one kind of giant mega repository, all that stuff is there, it's updated and it's uniform. But I would think that there is some institutional resistance, like ASCAP. How do you get it? How do you get people to sign on with the idea that they're going to leave and migrate away from this already accepted system, which has its problems but is known?
That's right there is kind of the challenge of what we're doing. But it's interesting to see that as these technologies have kind of become more known and understood, we're starting to see these projects pop up from institutional providers, essentially, that, wouldn't have probably otherwise occurred without, like, basically people thinking, okay, we should be more transparent. We should be, flowing better. Mm. For example, SACEM, which is a French performing rights organization, just announced last week that they're working with IBM to build a transparent copyright system. So,
but that's not a blockchain, is it? That's still a centralized, transparent but centralized system. Yes or no?
Not many details were given. So, okay. IBM is working with blockchain. It's one of their. It's something they've been focused on pretty heavily. They've started multiple kind of think tanks and groups kind of around this. So it could be built on blockchain. I don't know the answer to that, to be totally honest.
This is the other thing. As I was listening to this, I was thinking, okay, part of the value, though, is certainly as a user, I want everything in one place. If I have to go to like 12 different blockchain thing, that stinks. That's no good. And so,
absolutely.
And is it a first mover thing, like because you guys are existing first, that puts you in the right place? Or is it going to be a deep pockets, Spotify decides to implement blockchain and then can pay micropayments and they can adjust it and finally turn cash positive? Or, what's the financial model for you with Ujo? And then... So there's sort of two things that I'm curious about. One is your own business model, and then the other is your artist, creators, owners of IP. What's the incentive for them, which it seems pretty clear to me. It seems like they'll get more money and it'll be more transparent. Please tell me first about like where is your revenue? What's the revenue model for you? Because as I just said, Spotify is not cash positive. So how do you do this and be cash positive while still remitting greater transparency and funds?
So with Ujo, in the beginning, there's no clear business model, right? Especially if we want to start building, I guess, the rails for a new existing industry or for a new industry kind of to be born in this digital way. Mm-hmm. So there is no, at least from our point of view, it would be kind of against our beliefs to start charging for that. And so that's step one for us is to get something out there that does that. And, we aren't alone. There are probably 10 companies in blockchain and music or blockchain and entertainment that are trying to do something here. So,
okay. So it's sort of like a proof of use case that you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. And then, the services that get kind of built on top of the data, to us, that's where the value comes in. And, our belief is if you're providing value, you can extract value, but never more than you provide.
Ah, okay. That's very interesting. I mean, I think though that here's a question. I mean, so is it sort of you're altruistically coding the stuff, around the edges? I mean, I think one of the things that's, the ethos of the internet has been one of access versus ownership, that people want access and ownership is secondary. I mean, it's interesting to your point about, artists being compensated for their music. The whole issue around IP and copyright and whether people should get money, not everybody is 100% on board with that because people want to access it. And perhaps if that price point were these micropayments and it was lower, they wouldn't be so cavalier with wanting just to lift things for free.
I think we're starting to see a change in that behavior a little bit. And that comes, like you said, it comes down to access, right? For me at least, why does piracy exist? It exists because of the lack of access. You know, when in 1999, when Napster was first released, you had music on the internet for the first time, right? There was no way to pay for it. And because there was no way to pay for it, because the internet at the time couldn't handle payment, the pushback from the record industry was, this isn't going to work. People aren't going to want music on the internet. You know, we're not going to do this. And what happened, you know, as a result of that was people said, well, we do want this and we're going to have it, whether you like it or not, you know, which resulted in this huge kind of the boom for Napster until it got shut down.
Well, right. Well, I guess that's the one of the things then. So does blockchain, is there something inherent that would help prevent piracy of IP?
What blockchain kind of also enabled, which was really novel for the internet, was the concept of double spending something. So if you had money on the internet, or if you basically created a digital file, you can copy that, right?
Right.
And you can send it to someone and whatever. But with blockchains, you basically are creating unique digital items. So even if I copy that and then, now I send it, Gabrielle, I send you, five Bitcoins, and then I try to send those same five Bitcoins to someone else, the second transaction won't go through on the network.
Right. Because you've changed those coins by sending them to me. Is that?
Basically, you went into the book and you said, Jesse sends money to Gabriella. Now Gabriella has access to that and Jesse no longer has access to that. So now if Jesse tries to do that again, that's an invalid transaction. Those don't exist anymore.
Right.
So, our belief is that if we can reduce the barriers, and I guess this kind of goes back to your secondary question of, where's the buy-in for, why change anything for the existing people? The recorded music industry is shrinking. It's at half of the value it was 10 years ago, I believe. It's down to $15 billion for recorded music.
Well, and also, I suppose for those transactions, the sort of the pennies in the couch transactions, if you will, that a large organization doesn't want to do because they take too much labor to make them profitable. But if you have this just ability to capture micropayments and then gang them together and then issue them, then the artists can actually receive payment on things. And that's interesting. Do you think then that you actually will have more indie artists be interested than the big artists? Is that,
That's our main focus right now. So, we're working right now to release a product, basically an MVP in the next 6 to 8 weeks, that allows registration, allows listening of music, and we'll continue to add features, as we go. But basically, we want to just show artists that this is going to be a viable solution. We believe that there can be a middle class of artists,
Well, right, because in the music industry right now, correct me if I'm wrong, I could be totally wrong, but it seems to me that the way you actually make your money is on tour or through ancillary products and, sort of.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's an all or nothing thing, How many artists are making, a middle class income? They're making $50,000 to $150,000.
Right. So if you're going to launch the service, though, thinking now as a consumer, right now, let's say I have Spotify built into my phone, I have iTunes. What is the user experience with the service that makes me sign up for it? Because I can see the artist wanting to participate because it makes sense. But part of what's going to make the artist want to participate is knowing that you've got the users. So how are you going to get the users and what's their user experience going to be like?
Yeah. The consumers have it great right now. You said it, you have iTunes, you have Spotify, or any of your choice. You have basically your choice of services for your devices at a pretty standard rate of $10 a month for every song on the planet.
Right.
And that's awesome, right? As a consumer, that's great. But, I would challenge you at least, for me as a true music fan, it's like, how many times have you spent a few hours creating playlists and then they disappear? Have you ever lost your iTunes, for example?
Yes. I don't iTunes anymore because I've lost too many playlists.
Right. But what happens tomorrow if Spotify shuts down? What happens? It's a terrifying thought, but these companies aren't profitable and
But you know, until they shut down, I mean, just I'm really being horrible to you. I'm sorry. Until they shut down.
No,
I mean, this is like when I survey, because I did the survey of young millennials and you know, a third of them are pirating. And when talking to my clients who are these media companies about, you know, how do you stop piracy? And I say it's about access to the things they want and their experience. And so to your you nailed it when you said it's about access. But there's also another piece. I mean, for instance, there was a huge percentage of young millennials who actually pirated the debates. Okay, now that doesn't make sense. It was available for free. Why would you do that? Because you got in the habit of using the pirate site. That's where you go. That's your destination. Will the pirate site be shut down? Yeah, maybe eventually, and that will stink. But until it does, in order to convince me to change, I need something better.
Yeah, and you know, right in the beginning, it's not going to look better, right? You know, these are huge. Basically, we're kind of building with a lot of what they're doing with Ethereum and what we call Web3 is building a kind of a new internet that's secure and has payments through it. So this is not, you know, this is, I wish I could say that, you know, when we release our beta or our alpha really in 6 or 8 weeks, that it's going to be this amazing experience. But as a user, it's going to kind of take time. But what it can enable is these really interesting new concepts for users, for listeners. You know, what if you could be given essentially a digital token or something, right? A digital certificate or item that says, you know, you're a band's first listener, right? You're their first fan. And you were the first person to buy, you know, I don't know, Justin Bieber's new song, right? You know, for millennials, that's kind of interesting. You know, there's, and I'm not saying it's going to work because no one's ever really tested these concepts or ideas.
Right.
But, you know, I think that's kind of our responsibility is to go out and test and figure out what's going to work, what's going to create, you know, more value for everyone, right?
Right. Well, I think the other thing is it will depend a certain amount on, you know, you get the independent musicians who have a passionate following. And if they, for instance, say, I'm not going to have my music on Spotify, I'm only going to be here, you know, that I'm only going to be participating here, then that becomes interesting. Because then you have people migrate over, they start experiencing it. And then, you know, there's a certain amount of press and buzz when you start something new. And it's about, you know, pushing the boundaries, I think. But I think it's human behavior and the way people behave and changing that behavior is challenging. And I think that's why, you know, I never really thought about why everything was free on the internet. And it, as you pointed out, it's because the internet didn't take money. And so everything had to be free. And so then people got used to their experience of the internet was free stuff. And, you know, I was speaking to Mike Sheehan, who's CEO of the Boston Globe, and he was saying, you know, when he arrived, he's like, look, they were giving away the product for 10 years for free. And you can't write you can't investigate, you know, the horrible priests for free. You know, you gotta real journalism, exactly, which is important for the functioning of democracy and society, costs money. But who's ponying up the money? You know, who's willing to?
And I think we're gonna start seeing that, though. You know,
I think we will. But I also think that yes and no. I guess. I mean, I've been moved. Actually, by him, I now subscribe to like a million different newspapers, and I feel sort of patriotic in doing that. I guess the thing is that it's understanding and promoting and educating people about, you know, about art, about IP, about value. I mean, one of the things that was really interesting to me when we first released our report on young millennials and their penchant for ad blocking and piracy, and also, you know, you know, this large percent was pirating, and then it was 67% didn't think there was anything wrong with pirating. And that was the real big piece for me. It was like, wow, you know, how do you change behavior if they don't think it's wrong? You know, that all of this costs money, you know, to make. And if we like watching movies and we like watching intricate well-acted, high production value programs, then we need to pay for them. And yet the attitude certainly around streaming, you know, was it's not really, I'm not downloading it. So it's, you know, it's distributed. It's not a crime. Like, it totally is a crime. Somebody made that. Somebody worked really hard and they aren't getting any revenue.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think over the last few years we've seen, you know, I think news has evolved since the point where it's, you know, we want to start paying for it again because we want things we can trust, right? Because we've lost all trust in the news, especially after this past election.
Yeah. Well, certainly anything that's commercial supported, you start saying, well, you know,
right.
what's the incentive here?
And I think that, you know, and our hope is that that kind of, that those values and beliefs kind of also radiate around to the other industries, right? And so what if instead of paying $120 a year for music, which is higher than we've ever spent on average for music, you know, what if instead of paying $120 a year, you could spend, you know, $10 here, $2 there, $5 there, and then when it came time to go see the shows, you know, you get first access to the ticket because you're a supporter of that musician, you know?
Right, right.
And these are the things that having unique digital assets can enable, right? So,
right.
It's, you know, you were the first person to buy Justin Bieber's new song. You're the first person that gets access to his ticket sale, and you could pick wherever you want in the stadium. You know, like, wouldn't that be cool?
Right, right. So, right. Or you get access to, and he'll, you know, you'll understand his playlist. And so, because
right,
you're one of the artists.
Absolutely. Right. Or, you know, another example is, you know, instead of the concept of owning either equity in a song or equity in an artist, right? And the more successful they become, either the more clout that kind of gives you as a listener, or potentially there's a revenue share there, right? Maybe they give you, you know, one penny for every time you share their song or someone buys their song from your link, you know?
Right. I see. Oh, that's interesting. So that's interesting.
There's so many different ways I think we can try this. And if we don't, it feels negligent to the industry, and it feels negligent to the current state of the world and how things are shifting. So,
right. Gosh.
To us, it's like, it's almost like, come on, like, this just seems so
obvious. Do the right thing, really, right? I mean,
yeah, now at the heart of it. And, you know, I think we're starting to get to a world where people want to do the right thing, and especially if they could be publicly rewarded or publicly acknowledged or, you know, there's all these different incentive mechanisms that we can enable once we have unique digital assets, once we have payments that can be as low as, you know, a thousandth of a penny and can be transferred in instantly, right?
Right.
So once we have all this stuff, it's you know, you could see the 10x benefits, but getting there and proving that this is the future of things, you know, it's definitely no small challenge.
Right, right. So when are you guys launching?
So we're hoping to launch sometime Q1 of an MVP. Basically, it's going to be kind of pretty basic, but we're going to start, you know, telling this story and painting the picture of what the future of this looks like. And, you know, we hope that people are willing and want to join us on this ride.
What will be the web address that they would go to?
You could go to Ujo Music. That's ujomusic.com. And you'll be able to get all your information and check out the app from there.
Fantastic. We're at the end of the interview, and I have to thank you so much. We talked a little bit longer than 30 minutes, so
no worries.
Thank you for doing that. I really appreciate it. We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have helped bring the program to life. First, my friend Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Jesse Grishak. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.